Midnight in Karachi with Mavish Marad on tour.com.
Joining me today is N.K. Jemisin, writer of the Inheritance trilogy, the Dreamblood books, and now a new trilogy called The Broken Earth. She's been nominated for the Nebula, the Hugo, and the World Fantasy Award, as well as being shortlisted for the Tiptree Award. Her sixth novel is the wonderful The Fifth Season, which, well, I really, really enjoyed. Nora, welcome to Midnight in Karachi.
Oh, thank you.
Before we get to talking about what's new in your life, this fantastic new book, I wanted to go back right to the start. What sort of fiction did you start out writing? Was it always fantasy?
No. Well, I started out writing when I was 9 years old. So, yes, most of it was fantasy because it was about talking animals and things like that. If we're talking about when I started writing, I don't remember ever not writing in my life. But I spent a while writing nothing but science fiction when I was sort of developing as a writer. And I think some of that still shows in my writing, just because science fiction and fantasy are pretty much equal partners to me in creating other worlds to explore. So, yeah, basically I'd say I started out in science fiction, segued into fantasy, but never really separated the two that much.
So why epic fantasy? What do you think this genre, or even form in terms of novels, what was it about it that attracted you so much?
I didn't really get attracted to epic fantasy, which is sort of interesting. I write what I feel like writing. I send it to my agent and my editor, and I say, I don't know what this is, but can you sell it? And they come up with the marketing and the choices as far as what it fits into. I suppose it tends to fit into epic fantasy because in a lot of cases, I am talking about large-scale events, fate of the universe, and so forth, but I am not necessarily interested in following the conventions of the epic fantasy genre, where, you know, you've got so often the Tolkien and clones have dominated it in the past few decades, but where there has always been a broader space within epic fantasy for epic tales or large-scale tales of things that are not medieval Europe or variations on medieval European mythology. And I think that my work fits within that. I don't know whether to call it epic fantasy or just fantasy. I really don't even know that calling it fantasy is appropriate because I try and put as much realism, I suppose, or real science into the work as I can, simply because to me that lends it verisimilitude. I try not to use that word in ordinary conversation, but when I read a story, when I read something for myself, I want something that feels lived in and realistic, and using real social science, real science, these things are what helps to me.
You know, it's weird because I'm using the terms epic and epic fantasy because they're associated with your work, but I have to agree with you. I'm not sure if I would personally call them that either. We'll stick to, you know, good books for now. Okay. But it's hardly, you know, epic fantasy is hardly the genre that's been open to someone who wants to change the status quo or, you know, set stories that are not sort of European mythology or whatever it is that's sort of been associated with epic fantasy over the years. Or is that partly what you wanted to address in your story, is this great absurd tilt towards European settings in fantasy?
It's not in conversation with epic fantasy. If anything, I read epic fantasy, I get frustrated, and then I go write.
Right.
I don't think that I'm doing this as any kind of deliberate, you know, thumb nose to, I don't know if that works as a verb, nose thumbing to token clones or anything like that. I just don't find those kinds of books interesting, period. So I don't read them. And I want to read epic tales that remind me of the ancient epics that excite me. You know, when I read stories of Gilgamesh and Enkidu and you know, all of the various epics that I see in the world, that to me is what I'm in conversation with. You know, I suppose the Iliad instead of Tolkien.
Right.
But I want stories of gods coming down to earth and doing terrible things or hilarious things because human beings learn through conversation with their gods in various forms. I want stories of heroes overcoming incredible odds. That's a universal desire, I think. That's not something that's limited to the material that epic fantasy usually covers. So what I am interested in writing is the kinds of sagas that have always engaged humanity. That's not something that's unique to token-flavored epic fantasy. That's something that token-flavored epic fantasy has sort of tried to monopolize, but there's a lot more to it.
I personally find it really strange, having grown up in my part of the world with, say, you know, both Tolkien and the Arabian Nights side by side. And of course, a very sort of strong oral storytelling culture from within our own folktales that sort of resonates throughout the generations as well. So I always found it very weird that fantasy was tilted this way, or at least the commercially available fantasy, you know what I mean, the more commonly published stuff. Why do you think it's taken people so long to be open to reading fantasy that's set in worlds that are not, you know, European, for to use a very general term?
Well, I mean, I think that fantasy has always had a few sort of token examples. And I'm speaking here strictly of English language-based fantasy.
Right.
You know, we have to acknowledge the fact that there's a whole lot of stuff out there in other languages that we don't see.
Absolutely.
But that said, in English language fantasy, it is dominated by English flavored fantasy as well. So, you know, I don't think that it's necessarily that those stories haven't been told. They just haven't been told enough. There have always been the handful of things that popped in that were set in ancient China or set in ancient Arabia and so forth. But there has been the perception that in order to make money, and I think that that was really, you know, I'm going to throw Tolkien under the bus here. Tolkien wrote a wonderful, fascinating thing. He was trying to construct a mythology for medieval or for ancient England that he felt was lacking, and which kind of surprises me because there's so much there. But you know, he was trying to construct a mythology for his time and for his people, and he made a crap ton of money doing that. And so the word went out in the industry and elsewhere that the way to make a crap ton of money was to focus on English mythology.
Right.
And I think that's really what sort of narrowed the field. Before that, you saw a lot of things that ranged much farther afield. You saw Hope Miralles, why am I drawing a blank on the name of that book? Oh, that's terrible. Well, if you look up Hope Miralles, and anyone who's listening to this actually is familiar with the book, but you've seen a lot of fairly varied stuff before Tolkien, and the bottleneck kicks in after that. The bottleneck always did allow a few things through that were not strictly that, not strictly related to what Tolkien did. But I don't actually scratch that. Let me not just blame Tolkien. Let me also throw Dungeons and Dragons under the bus.
Right.
And I love Dungeons and Dragons. Let me just be clear. But I think that a lot of people around maybe the 70s or 80s or so, the 80s in the case of D&D, started to see the commercialization of European medieval flavored fantasy as the way to go. And again, that helped narrow the field further. So I think that's what we're dealing with here is post-Tolkien and post D&D in the sense of post-apocalyptic and what that did to the fantasy landscape.
Now, what appeals to you as a reader, and is it hugely different now from what you used to read when you were a child?
No. You know, I have read a few Tolkien clones. David Eddings is a Belgariad and so forth. I just, you know, sort of read them when I was young, thought, okay, this is interesting, and then moved on to other things. But I read a little bit of everything. I don't stick just to fantasy. You know, one of my favorite things to read for fun has always been mythology. So I think in that sense, yes, what I'm writing is related to what I read as a child, because as a child I was reading the tales of Hercules or the tales of just various mythologies. I've always been fascinated by coyote tales, which are various Native American cultures,
right.
trickster tales. Trickster tales in general have always fascinated me. Some of the more recent mythologies that fascinated me were the tales of Brer Rabbit, which have various prominence, but are considered sort of uniquely American tales created through the combination of oral traditions from American slaves and from Europeans who heard those and wrote them down and sometimes altered them and so forth. But these are still more recent creations that emulate older traditions. Almost every culture has a trickster saga somewhere, and this was ours. So those kinds of stories always fascinated me, and I do write that.
Now that you're half a dozen books in, has your writing process changed any?
I am not as uncomfortable with the lack of process that I have.
Right.
I will create an outline, and then I will ignore the outline and write what I feel like, and then I will remember that I have an outline and come back to it and sort of freak out at how completely off the outline that I've gone. And then I will rewrite the outline and try to get back to it. And yeah, I am more comfortable with winging it now because I've begun to realize that I'm just not the kind of person who sticks to the plan. I have had to do that more with the Broken Earth trilogy simply because there's so many pies in the sky and I've got to keep them all there. So many plot threads, so many intrigues, so many factions. But that said, I like free writing. I like writing what, you know, sort of inspires me or whatever whim takes me in a particular direction or not. So I've gotten more comfortable with letting that happen.
Now, we were talking about this just before we started recording, so I'm going to go back to that. The Killing Moon was the first novel you wrote, but it wasn't the first you published, I believe. I can imagine, you know, some of the reasons behind why it was rejected initially. Obviously, it wasn't the sort of fantasy that many publishers were familiar with or comfortable with or, you know, wanting to take a risk on, given it was in this sort of quasi-Egyptian setting, if I can call it that. What was the experience like having created this fantastic world and then being told, yeah, no, I don't know, it's a great risk? I mean, I have to say, I'm really glad you didn't stop doing what you were doing.
Thank you, because I came very close to doing that. It was a very long 2 or 3 years or so between me getting an agent for The Killing Moon and me actually selling something. And that was the novel that was eventually called The 100,000 Kingdoms. And during that time, I called up my agent and said, you know, look, I haven't made you a dime. You know, I'm feeling uncomfortable about this. You've told me all along that you believe in this book and that you want to see it published, but you know, I've had to basically give up on that and start writing something completely different because it was just clear after a while scratch that. I will say that several publishing houses made it clear that they would be interested in trying The Killing Moon if it were less risky. They perceived it as a risk. If I sold something else, built up an audience, and then it was something that they could then take a chance on because they would be selling an N.K. Jemisin book and not a fantasy full of black people, which is really what it kind of came down to.
Right.
The quasi-Egyptian setting, I don't think, was quite as much of a deterrent as the fact that there were very few characters in it who were described as anything other than black.
Well, it was quasi-Egyptian. What were they expecting?
Remember that this is the country of Elizabeth Taylor as Cleopatra.
Yes, and of course.
I just want to ignite the whole debate about whether Cleopatra could have been blue-eyed and
yes,
white.
Yes, there's a debate? This is news to me.
In America there is, yes.
Oh, of course there is. In America there's a debate about everything, from what I hear. But
that's true. But yes, so, you know, the truth is that the Egyptians were neither black nor white or anything that we would classify as either. But that said, you know, it's something that still to this day kind of makes me a little angry. And I think it should make me angry because it's an indicator of what the industry was like literally just 10 years ago. That really wasn't very long.
Yeah.
That I started getting the rejections for that book. And it is a part and parcel of the bottleneck effect that I was describing as the result of the domination of medieval European-based fantasy, and the implication that fantasy, therefore, could only be medieval European and could only be about a stalwart young white guy who is a farm boy who discovers that he is secretly a king, who gets the girl, who brings the object of significance to the place of importance, yada, yada, yada. And in fact, I actually thought that with The Killing Moon, because it was about a stalwart guy who happened to be black, bringing, you know, ultimately a secret of significance, right, or a person of significance to a place of importance, I made that story as much as I could emulate the forms of epic fantasy.
Right.
You know, at varying points, there's a journey. The protagonist has his stalwart companions, you know, all these other things. But it just wasn't formulaic enough, I suppose. And the core of the formula that people rejected was racial. So I came very close to quitting. I told my agent, let's sever this relationship. You can go find someone who will make you more money. I will wait until I've written a good book that is a little more conventional, I guess, if I want to do that. And frankly, I got angry with the idea that I would have to do something like that. And honestly, that anger informs The 100,000 Kingdoms, because with The 100,000 Kingdoms, at that point, I was pissed. I was like, you know, okay, so the fantasy genre doesn't want my very conventional fantasy novel full of black people. I'm going to give them a completely unconventional fantasy novel, and it'll have white people all through it, but the protagonist is going to be a person of color, and I'm going to mention that. I'm going to mention it repeatedly. I'm going to point out their racism.
Right.
I'm going to point out, you know, the various classisms and other intersectional things that they're arraying against this woman. And I ended up essentially writing a fantasy about oppressive systems. And who the protagonist is a woman who is described as not pretty and angry, and I thought that was the thing that made it break out. So I was surprised but pleased with the reaction that The 100,000 Kingdoms ultimately got. But it was written in a state of F word to the fantasy genre.
Right. it seems like a horrible thing for me to say right now, but in a way, I'm very glad that you felt that anger. Because if at that point you hadn't felt it, you might not have pushed through and broken through into sort of, you know, a string of these books that have then repeatedly tried to and have at many times shoved at the status quo. And I'm not suggesting you did it rudely, you know, in the way that you said every time. But that anger kind of fueled, as you said, The 100,000 Kingdoms. And is it still there? Do you still feel it when you still write now?
Do I still feel the anger?
Yeah.
I feel the anger at the world at this point, because the status quo that you mentioned is not something that exists just within fantasy, certainly. It is fantasy is a reflection of American society right now, and that tendency to treat the desire for an equal place at the table as rude. It's almost impossible to push against the status quo and not be perceived as rude, simply because the designation of what is considered polite is in line with the status quo. So, you know, I feel frustrated that the things that I am doing are perceived as groundbreaking, because they're not. I'm writing stories that emulate epics more ancient than most of the civilizations that remain on this planet. I am not doing anything new or unique here. I am writing women as human beings. I am writing people of color as leaders and lead roles. These are things that everyone wants to see in fantasy. I am angry with the pushback that I get for sometimes doing this perfectly normal, perfectly human thing. And so, yeah, I'm still angry because there are people who are surprised or frustrated or freaked out that I do this.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
the anger is with the system that makes those people think the way they do, and not with anyone in particular.
I have to say, though, you're absolutely right, because the fact that if we're going out of our way to admire these things that should be the norm, it just kind of tells you how, you know, messed up the system is and how systemic the problems are. Of course, I can still admire your work, and I can still admire your stories for the stories they are and for what they're trying to do, as well as at the same time be, you know, again, sad that you are forced to do this or that you have to do this and that it is lauded on as something so different. It shouldn't be so different. It should be all over the place.
I mean, I would write anyway. I have written all my life for fun, for stress relief, for all sorts of other things. And I pride myself in being a good writer, regardless of the subject matter that I am doing. And as far as I'm concerned, good writing involves being able to put different kinds of people into different kinds of situations and render that plausibly. I do not believe that there's only one kind of hero. I do not believe that the hero's journey is the only way to tell a story. And I just simply try to model that in my writing. And I try to model the fact that I perceive everyone to be equally able to tell a story and be equally engaging to all readers. And I simply try to model that in my writing. If it manages to come across, then good. I am doing what I set out to do, which is to be a good writer. And those who perceive what I do as ideologically driven, I think, do not understand what writing should be. They understand what formula should be. And maybe if I continue to demonstrate it as well as I can, and maybe if other people join in and start to demonstrate this inclusiveness as good writing, then maybe the world will change. I can hope.
Let's talk about the fifth season now. Not too much, because I don't want to ruin it for everyone, but I do want to talk about it because I really, really liked it. Repeated apocalypses, this idea of not one, but many seasons of destruction, of, you know, the end happening again and again, seasons that can last decades or centuries or millennia, and yet somehow people that still survive, still carry on, societies that sort of pick up and continue or reform after all these seasons have passed. Where did this premise come from?
That part I really don't know. I've always liked dystopian post-apocalyptic fiction, just in general. I've always liked stories of starting over after the end, but what fascinates me even more are not stories, you know. Okay, so I think that the core of post-apocalyptic stories is that they serve our desire to say that everything around us is just crap and let's start over. Let's rebuild, let's do a better job of what our predecessors put together and gave us, and so on. And I think that there's a fallacy in that kind of thinking. Because first of all, it assumes that you can actually have such a thing as a complete fresh start. As long as you've got people alive who remember the way things used to be, that's not possible.
Right.
The only way to have a fresh start is to start us all over as babies, and with no books or knowledge left over from the old world. But the other piece of that fantasy is that it is often driven by people who think that the apocalypse is not going to be a big deal. And I think part of what I wanted to explore was a world where the apocalypse isn't a big deal, where it happens so often that society has literally configured itself around that. To me, that seemed like an ironic deconstruction of post-apocalyptic stuff, because if the apocalypse becomes old hat, if you are starting civilization over again and again and again, if your society is built around the idea of starting civilization over, then that just sort of was a way to sort of poke at the we can have a fresh start, we can rebuild the world, we can make it better, stronger, faster. I like the idea of just playing with that concept, and also playing with and poking at the ugliness and sort of danger inherent in assuming that the people who came before you were terrible and what they did should be forgotten. Because I'm a firm believer in the idea that those who forget the past are doomed to repeat it. And those who do not recognize the value of what their ancestors did are doomed to screw up ginormously. And I don't think that really counts as a good proverb, but that's the one I'm making up. So, yeah, I will leave it at that.
Now, this concept of orogeny, am I pronouncing it correctly?
Yes, I think. It's a scientific word, actually.
Right, I know. So I was guessing, too. But amazing. I mean, how, where, why did this come from? And I have to ask, were you very well versed in physical geography before you started writing this book?
No. No, I was not. I have told the story, and I told this at my launch party last night, that the story was inspired by a dream of a woman who I now know as Esun, who was walking towards me in this, you know, the badass power walk is kind of what they call it in comic books and in movies, where you see the heroes walking towards the camera in slow motion, sometimes with like an explosion behind them,
right,
and looking very powerful and very grim and determined. So I had a dream of Esun walking towards me in the badass power walk, but with a mountain floating along behind her. And I knew that she was about to throw this mountain at me. And so all of this grew out of my need to explain, why does this woman have a mountain following her around? And how can she throw it at me? And why is she trying to throw it at me? And what did I do to piss her off this much? And so the whole idea of people who can move mountains precipitated me having to learn about how do mountains get made. And the process of mountain formation is called orogeny. And I ended up having to learn a whole lot about geography. I'm sorry, well, geography too. Geology, plate tectonics, seismology, all kinds of things. And some of this was just simply fun for me because I think volcanoes are cool.
Right.
And some of this was just fascinating. I am the kind of reader who will pick a particular subject area, and if it's even vaguely interesting to me, I will geek out over it for years. And I have been geeking out over geology for the last few years, and it's been a lot of fun.
Now, just one question that's in a little more detail about the actual writing. One of the main characters from whom we have a point of view narrative, you just mentioned her, Esun, a woman who is searching for her child, let's leave it at that, having hidden what she is, what her children are, for quite some time. She's done this. Now, Esun's point of view chapters are told in the second person, which is not common, especially when it's one of multiple points of view narratives in a book. It's quite a risky way to tell a story. Where did that come from? How did you make that choice?
I didn't make it as a conscious choice. I kind of have a short attention span as writers go. I get bored of doing the same thing in the same way. I like to experiment with different styles, different voices, different modes, to see what feels best. And when I am writing a new novel or a new story just in general, I will often write what I call test chapters, where I'll write one introduction to the story from one character's point of view, or in the next chapter, I'll switch it to a different character. I will try first person, third person, and then just something told me to try second person with Esun, and it worked. I was reaching for a level of, I wanted a kind of distant intimacy, if that does not sound like an oxymoron. Esun is a fundamentally alien person to us. She should be. She has senses that we do not have. She has an understanding of the world that no human being on this planet could possibly possess, because we don't have that sixth sense that she has. And I wanted to make it very clear to readers that this is a world of people who are vastly different from us. I wanted her to be identifiable and understandable, but I wanted that distance to remain in place. And I tried first person, and first person was too intimate. I'm not really sure why. I think because first person puts you inside a person's head without giving you any distance. But the you of second person forces a distance. you can't possibly be that person because you don't have a child who has been murdered. You don't have the ability to move mountains. So the distance is going to be there inherently because of second person. But at the same time, it has some of the intimacy of first person. So it just seemed to be the right way to do it. Asun is going to do some really horrific things over the course of this story. And some of them she's forced into, and some of them she does because she's been through hell. And I didn't necessarily want readers identifying with her, but I wanted them to understand why she did these things. I wanted a thorough examination of this character, because she's going to be a complex and in some ways, not likable character. And I'm not going for likability, I'm going for understandability, if that's a word. So second person seemed to be the best way to do it. I see a lot of stuff about how women protagonists in fiction are judged on their likability in ways that you know, male protagonists are not. You know, you can see Gene Wolfe write about a torturer, and it's not a huge deal. But what was that, Gene Wolfe? Oh, gosh, my coffee is thin today.
Yeah.
But, you know, you can see male writers write about characters who are distinctly unlikable, do distinctly horrific things, and that seems to be much more acceptable than women characters doing despicable things.
Right.
And it frustrates me that that double standard exists, and so... you know, and yet I have to deal with it. And yet I still have to sell books to a readership that is still going to judge my female characters more harshly because they are female. I actually did a sort of completely non-scientific study a few months back on my blog where I went and deliberately looked at the one-star reviews for some of my earlier works. And compared the ones for the women against the ones for the ones for the books where there's a woman protagonist against the ones for my male protagonists. And I saw the women being dinged for the same things that the male characters got no comment on.
Right.
You know, male characters do despicable things. No one seems to hate them. Women characters do one thing that's slightly off, and they were excoriated. So, I mean, I know that this affects my readership. I know that this affects my ability to sell books. And so when I decided to write a story about a character who, just simply by dint of the fact that she is capable of creating mass disasters, is going to kill a whole lot of people, even by accident, I needed to find a way to make this character comprehensible. I don't think it's possible to make her likable. I don't know. I mean, readers may tell me differently, but I wasn't trying for likability. The only thing I could do was try and make her human and as give readers a way to hook into exactly who and what she is so that they're not judging her on the superficiality of whether she is likable or not.
Well, I was quite destroyed by the treatment of the origins in the fifth season by other people. How they were needed, but ostracized. They were raised to be bound, you know, into and inside the system, even though they were the ones with sort of more power than most people. They were bred like animals. So much of it then just reminded me of the way over the years entire nations, you know, the world over, have been colonized, taken over, enslaved. What sort of stories, what sort of histories were you drawing on to tell the stories of the origins?
Well, I was drawing on my own experience as an African-American descendant of slaves. I'm drawing on modern incarnations of the treatment of African Americans within our country, the fact that we are still very much second-class citizens despite the civil rights era and so forth. I was drawing on things like the Indian Raj. I was drawing on quite a bit of existing colonialism and history. The most insidious methods of enslavement were the ones that appeared to be participated in by the colonized, the ones where they would take up the stories of oppression themselves or take up the methods of oppression themselves and apply them to themselves.
Right.
you know, for example, the fact that the Fulcrum is actually run by Orogenes. It is not run by the government or anything like that. It's something that they did to themselves in order to try and essentially make a bargain with the world, saying, don't kill us and we will restrict ourselves in these ways to make you comfortable. I see oppressed peoples all over the world make those bargains all the time, and I wanted to get at that. That said, there are still some things that I think are very much part of the way that the world, part of actual history. There were definite real historical inspirations in there. Certainly the fact that American slaves were bred, especially after the importation of new slaves was made illegal. Most of the slaves at that point from then on in the United States were created through rape or forced breeding on the part of their masters, forcing the slaves to do this with each other or with themselves. So that came in. There was another historical incident which I trying to figure out a way to vaguely allude to it, but I will simply say that there were a number of slaves who made choices to keep their children out of slavery that would be horrific to us, that are horrific to us in retrospect. These are people who chose to mutilate their children, to kill their children in some cases, rather than let them be enslaved. That was actually a fairly common thing. And so I was inspired by stories of this. Resistance against oppression takes a lot of forms. It is not always a rebellion. In some cases, it's quieter, darker, and these were the things that I wanted to explore.
Now, moving on to something a little lighter, Jonah has asked on Twitter, what would you do with 6 months and no obligations?
Mm-hmm. I would probably, in 6 months, I don't think that I could do a novel, but I would probably write a bunch of short stories and at least get started on a novel, because that's actually what I did at one point. After the 100,000 Kingdoms sold, I had enough money to take 1 year off of work. And I did that for about 3 months to see what the no obligations lifestyle was like. And I got bored. I couldn't stand it more than 3 months. And then I went and got a part-time job because I was bored out of my mind. But in that time, I wrote the better part of the Broken Kingdoms and outlined the Kingdom of Gods, and in fact got most of the Kingdom of Gods done. So with 6 months and no obligations, I might get bored and go get myself some obligations, but I would certainly write a whole lot.
So what's next for you? I know there's another book coming along. Is that next year?
Probably. The second book of the trilogy, which has a tentative name in my head, but I don't know if we're going to stick with that, so I won't mention it. We'll just call it Book 2. Is almost done. I'm at roughly 90,000 words right now. I'm guesstimating it will be roughly about the same size as the fifth season, same length as the fifth season. So it's due at the end of August. I am very likely to turn it in on that date. And if so, barring major revisions or anything that requires me to completely overhaul the thing, then I believe it's scheduled to come out next year. And then I'm going to immediately start book 3 so that again, that can come out the following year. In the case of trilogies, you don't want your readership to wait forever. And a lot of readers will not buy the first book of a trilogy unless they see some clear signs that the second or third book is coming soon on the horizon. Largely because there've been so many writers who kind of stiffed their audience, with years in between books,
right.
And I can't afford to do that.
So you have your next couple of years mapped
out. So I'll get those done. Next year and a half. I'm almost done with book 2, like I said. So really the next year is mapped out with book 3. But I already have an idea in mind for another story that I'm going to write after that. And I haven't had time to really sit down and outline it and figure out whether it's a standalone or what. I've actually written a short story in that universe. And we will see if it sells, and we'll see what I come up with after that.
Well, I'm looking forward to that.
No, so am I.
And I hope we'll speak to you again. Thank you so much for taking the time out to speak to me today.
Oh, this is a lot of fun.
Midnight in Karachi with Mavish Murad on tour.com.